Chapter 31. Petty Arthur warns me that if I keep on listening to that noisy jazz music, I'll wind up like the Lennon brothers, so American I'll forget I'm Irish altogether. And what will I be then? It's no use telling him how the Lennons could be so excited about James Joyce. He'd say, "Oh, James Joyce, me arse. I grew up in the county Cavan, and no one there ever heard of him. And if you don't watch your step, you'll be running to Harlem and jitterbugging with Negro girls." He's going to an Irish dance on Saturday night, and if I have any sense, I'll go with him. He wants to dance only with Irish girls, because if you dance with Americans, you never know what you're getting. At the Jager House on Lexington Avenue, Mickey Carton is up there with his band, and Ruthie Morrissey singing "A Mother's Love is a Blessing." A great crystal ball revolves in the ceiling, flecking the ballroom with floating silver spots. Paddy Arthur is no sooner in the door than he's waltzing around with the first girl he asked to dance. He has no trouble getting girls to dance, and why should he? With his 6'1", his black curly hair, his rich black eyebrows, his blue eyes, the dimple on his chin, the cool way he has of offering his hand that says, "Come up, girl," so that the girl would never dream of saying no to this vision of a man. And when they move out on the floor, no matter what class of a dance it is, waltz, foxtrot, lindy, two-step, he steers her around with a hardly a glance at her. And when he leads her back to her seat, she's the envy of every giggling girl on the seats along the wall. He comes to the bar where I'm having a beer for the curries that might be in it. He wants to know why I'm not up dancing. "Sure, what's the use coming here if you don't dance with them grand girls along the wall?" He's right. The grand girls sitting along the wall are like the girls in Cruz's Hotel in Limerick, except they're wearing dresses the likes of which you'd never see in Ireland, silk and taffeta, a material strange to me, pink, puce, light blue, ornamented here and there with lacy bows, dresses with no shoulders, so stiff at the front that when the girl turns to the right, the dress stays where it is. Their hair is trapped with pins and combs for fear it might tumble rich to the shoulders. They sit with their hands in their laps, holding fancy purses, and they smile only when they talk to each other. Some sit dance after dance, ignored by the men, till they're forced to dance with the girls beside them. They clump across the floor, and when the dance ends, move to the bar for lemonade or orange squash, the drink of girl couples. I can't tell Paddy I'd rather stay where I am, safe at the bar. I can't tell him that going to any kind of a dance gives me a sick, empty feeling, that even if a girl got up to dance with me, I wouldn't know what to say to her. I could manage the waltz, oompa oompa, but I could never be like the men on the floor who whisper and make girls laugh so hard they can hardly dance for a whole minute. Buck used to say in Germany that if you can make a girl laugh, you're halfway up her leg. Paddy dances again and comes to the bar with a girl named Maura, tells me she has a friend, Dolores, who's shy because she's Irish-American. Would I dance with her since I was born here, and we'd make a good match with her ignorance of Irish dancing and my listening to that jazz music all the time? Maura looks up at Paddy and smiles. He smiles down at her and winks at me. She says, "Excuse me, I want to make sure Dolores is okay." And when she's gone, Paddy whispers she's the one he's going home with. She's a head waitress in Schraff's restaurant with her own apartment, saving her money to go back to Ireland, and this will be Paddy's lucky night. He says I should be nice to Dolores, you never know, and he winks again. "I think they'll be getting me whole tonight," he says. "Me whole. Of course, that's what I'd like myself, but that's not the way I'd say it. I prefer Mikey Malloy's way of saying it in Limerick when he called it the excitement. If you're like Paddy, with Irish women jumping into your arms, you probably don't remember one from another, and they all become one whole, until you meet the girl you like, and she makes you realize she wasn't put into the world to fall on her back for your pleasure. I could never think about Mike Small like that, or even Dolores, who's standing there blushing and shy, the way I feel myself." Paddy nudges me and talks out of the side of his mouth, "Ask her to dance, for Christ's sake." All that comes out of me is a mumble. And I'm lucky Mickey Carton is playing a waltz with Ruthie singing There's One Fair County in Ireland, the only dance where I might not make a fool of myself. Dolores smiles at me and blushes, and I blush back. And there go the two of us, blushing around the floor, with the little silver spots floating across our faces. If I stumble, she steps along with me in such a way that the stumble becomes a dance step. And after a while, I think I'm Fred Astaire and she's Ginger Rogers. And I whirled her around, sure the girls along the wall are admiring me and dying for a dance with me. The waltz stops, and even though I'm ready to leave the floor for fear Mickey might start a Lindy or a Jitterbug, Dolores pauses as if to say, why don't we dance this? And she's so easy on her feet and so light with her touch. I look at the other couples, how cool they are. And it's no trouble at all to do it with Dolores, whatever it is. And I push her and pull her and twirl her like a top till I'm sure all the girls are eyeing me and envying Dolores, till I'm so full of myself I don't notice there's a girl sitting near the door with a crutch sticking out where it shouldn't be. And when my foot catches in it, I go flying into the laps of the grand girls along the wall, who push me off in a rough, unfriendly way, remarking that some people shouldn't be allowed on the dance floor if they can't hold their drink. Paddy is at the door with his arm around Maura. He's laughing, but she's not. She looks at Dolores as if to sympathize with her, but Dolores helps me to my feet, asking me if I'm all right. Maura comes over and whispers to her and turns to me, will you take care of Dolores? I will. She and Paddy leave, and Dolores says she'd like to leave too. She lives in Queens, and she says I really don't have to see her all the way home. The E-train is safe enough. I can't tell her I'd like to take her home in the hope she might ask me in, and there might be some excitement. She surely has her own apartment, and she might feel so sorry over the way I tripped over the crutch. She wouldn't have the heart to turn me away, and we'd be in her bed in no time, warm, naked, mad for each other, missing mass, breaking the sixth commandment over and over and not giving a fiddler's fart. When the E-train rocks or stops quickly, we're thrown together, and I can smell her perfume and feel her thigh against mine. It's a good sign when she doesn't pull away from me, and when she lets me hold her hand, I'm in heaven, till she starts talking about Nick, her boyfriend in the Navy. And I put her hand back in her lap. I can't understand the women in this world, Mike Small, who drinks beer with me in Rockies and then runs to Bob. Now this one, who lures me onto the E-train all the way to the last stop at 179th Street. Paddy Arthur would never have put up with this. Back at the dance hall, he would have made certain there was no Nick in the Navy and no one at home to interfere with his all-night plans. If there was any doubt, he'd have jumped off the train at the next stop, so why don't I? I was soldier of the week in Fort Dix, I trained dogs, I go to college, I read books, and look at me now, sneaking through the streets around NYU to avoid Bob the football player, and taking a girl home who's planning to marry someone else. It seems everyone in the world has someone, Dolores her Nick, Mike Small her Bob, and Paddy Arthur is well into his night of excitement with Maura in Manhattan. And what kind of a bloody fool am I, traveling to the end of the line? I'm ready to jump off at the next stop and leave Dolores entirely, when she takes my hand and tells me how nice I am, that I'm a good dancer, too bad about the crutch. We could have danced all night, that she likes the way I talk. Such a cute brogue. You can tell I was well brought up. It's so nice that I got to college. And she doesn't understand why I'm hanging around with Paddy Arthur, who, it was easy to see, had no good in his mind with respect to Maura. She squeezes my hand and tells me I'm so nice to travel all the way home with her, and she'll never forget me. And I feel her thigh against mine all the way to the last stop. And when we stand to leave the train, I have to bend to hide the excitement that's throbbing in my trousers. I'm ready to walk her home, but she stands by a bus stop and tells me she lives farther out in Queens Village, and really, I don't have to go all the way. She'll be all right on the bus. She squeezes my hand again. And I wonder if there's any hope that this might be my lucky night, and I'll wind up wild in bed like Paddy Arthur. While we wait for the bus, she holds my hand again, tells me all about Nick in the Navy, how her father doesn't like him because he's Italian, and calls him all kinds of insulting names behind his back. How her mother really likes Nick, but would never admit it in case her father might come home in a drunken rage and smash the furniture, which wouldn't be the first time. The worst nights are when her brother Kevin visits and stands up to her father, and you wouldn't believe the swearing and the rolling on the floor. Kevin is a linebacker at Fordham and a good match for her father. What's a linebacker? You don't know what a linebacker is?
I don't.
You're the first boy I ever met who didn't know what a linebacker is.
Boy.
I'm 24 years old and she's calling me a boy. And I'm wondering, do you have to be 40 to be a man in America? All along, I'm hoping that things are so terrible with her father she might have her own place, but no, she lives at home. And there go my dreams for a night of excitement. You think a girl her age would have her own place, so she could invite in the likes of me who see her to the end of the line? I don't care if she squeezes my hand 1,000 times. What's the use of having your hand squeezed in a bus in the middle of the night in Queens if there's no promise of a bit of excitement at the end of the journey? She lives in a house with a statue of the Virgin Mary and a pink bird in the little front lawn. We stand at the small iron gate, and I'm wondering if I should kiss her and get her into such a state we might go behind a tree for the excitement. But there's a roar from inside. God damn it, Dolores, get your ass in here. Hell of a nerve you have coming home at this goddamn hour and tell that goddamn shithead of a Mick run for his life. And she says, oh, and runs inside. By the time I get back to Mary O'Brien's, everyone is up and having bacon and eggs, followed by Roman slices of pineapple in heavy syrup. Mary puffs on her cigarette and gives me the knowing smile.
Well, you look like you had a good time last night.
Chapter 32. When the day workers at the bank leave their offices, Bridie Stokes comes in with her mop and bucket to clean three floors. She pulls a large canvas bag behind her, fills it with trash from the waste paper baskets, and drags it to the freight elevator to empty it somewhere in the basement. Andy Peters tells her she should have extra canvas bags, so that she won't have to travel up and down so much, and she says the bank won't supply even one more canvas bag, they're that cheap. She could buy them herself, but she's working nights to keep her son Peter at Fordham University and not to be supplying the manufacturer's trust company with canvas bags. Every night on each floor she fills the bag twice, and that means six trips to the basement. Andy tries to explain to her that if she had six canvas bags, she could fill the elevator once, and that would save so much time and energy she could finish earlier and go home to Patrick and her husband. Husband? He drank himself to death 10 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that, says Andy Peters.
I'm not a bit sorry. He was too handy with his fists, and I bear the marks to this day, Patrick too. He'd think nothing of knocking little Patrick around the house till the little fella couldn't even cry anymore. It was so bad one night, I took him from the house and begged the man in the subway booth to let us in. And I asked the cop where was Catholic Charities, and they took care of us and got me this job. And I'm grateful, even if there's only one canvas bag. Andy tells her she doesn't have to be a slave. I'm not a slave. I'm up in the world since I got away from that lunatic, God forgive me. But I didn't even go to his funeral. She lets out a sigh and leans on the handle of the mop, which comes up to her chin. She's that small. She has large brown eyes and no lips, and when she tries to smile, there's nothing to smile with. She's so thin that when Andy and I go out to the coffee shop, we bring her a cheeseburger with French fries and a milkshake to see if we could put some fat on her bones, till we realize she's not touching the food but taking it home to Patrick, who's studying accounting at Fordham. Then one night we find her crying and stuffing the freight elevator with six bulging canvas bags. There's room for us with the bags, and we ride on with her, wondering if the bank suddenly turned generous and lavished canvas bags on her. No, 'tis my Patrick. One more year and he'd be graduated from Fordham. But he left me with a note to say he's in love with a girl from Pittsburgh and they're gone off to start a new life in California. And I said to myself, if that's the way I'm going to be treated, I'm not going to kill myself with the one canvas bag anymore. And I went up and down the streets of Manhattan till I found a place on Canal Street that sells them, a Chinese place. You'd think in a city like this, you wouldn't have any trouble finding canvas bags. And I don't know what I'd do without the Chinese. She cries harder and pulls the sleeve of her sweater across her eyes. Andy says, all right, Mrs. Stokes. Bridie, she says, I'm Bridie now. All right, Bridie. We'll go across the street and you can eat something for your strength. Ah, no. I have no appetite. Take off the apron, Bridie. We're going across the street. She tells us in the coffee shop. She doesn't even want to be Bridie anymore. She's Bridget. Bridie is a name for skivvies and Bridget has the bit of dignity. No, she could never manage a cheeseburger, but she eats it and all the French fries slathered with ketchup and tells us her heart is broken, while she sucks her milkshake through a straw. Andy wants her to explain why she suddenly decided to get the canvas bag. She doesn't know. There was something about Patrick leaving like that, and the memories of the way her husband beat her that opened a little door in her head. And that's all she can say about it. The days of the one bag are over. Andy says there's no rhyme nor reason to it. She agrees, but she doesn't care anymore. She got off the Queen Mary over 20 years ago, a healthy girl excited over America, and look at her now, a scarecrow. Well, her scarecrow days are over too, and she'd love a piece of apple pie if they have it. Andy says he studies rhetoric, logic, philosophy, but this is beyond him. And she says they're very slow with the apple pie. There are books to be read, term papers written. But I'm so obsessed with Mike Small, I sit at the library window and watch her movements along Washington Square, between the main university building and the Newman Club, where she goes between classes, even though she's not a Catholic. When she's with Bob, the football player, my heart sinks, and that song runs through my head. I wonder who's kissing her now, though I know very well who's kissing her now. Mr. Football Player himself, 200 pounds of him, bending to plant his lips on hers. And even though I know I'd like him if there were no Mike Small in the world, he's that decent and good-humoured, I still want to find the back of a comic book where Charles Atlas promises to help me build muscles that will let me kick sand in Bob's face the first time I meet him at the beach. When summer comes, he puts on his ROTC uniform and travels to North Carolina for training. And Mike Small and I are free to meet in Rome Greenwich Village, eating at Monty's on McDougal Street, drinking beer at the White Horse or the San Remo. We ride the Staten Island ferry, and it's lovely to stand on deck hand in hand, to watch the Manhattan skyline recede and loom, even though I can't stop thinking again of the ones who were sent back with the bad eyes and the bad lungs, and wondering what it was like for them in towns and villages all over Europe, once they had a glimpse of New York, the tall towers over the water, and the way the lights twinkle at dusk with tugboats hooting and ships blaring in the narrows. Did they see and hear all this through the windows at Ellis Island? Did the memory bring pain? And did they ever again try to slip into this country through a place where there weren't men in uniform rolling back their eyelids and tapping at their chests? When Mike Small says, what are you thinking about? I don't know what to say, for fear she might think I'm peculiar, the way I wonder about the ones who were sent back. If my mother or father had been sent back, I wouldn't be on this deck with the lights of Manhattan, a sparkling dream before me. Besides, it's only Americans who ask questions like that, what are you thinking about, or what do you do? In all my years in Ireland, no one ever asked me such questions. And if I weren't madly in love with Mike Small, I'd tell her mind her own business about what I'm thinking or what I do for a living. I don't want to tell Mike Small too much about my life because of the shame.
and I don't think she'd understand, especially when she grew up in a small American town where everyone had everything. But when she starts talking about her days in Rhode Island with her grandmother, there are clouds. She talks about swimming in the summer, ice skating in the winter, hay rides, trips to Boston, dates, proms, editing her high school yearbook. And her life sounds like a Hollywood movie, till she goes back to the time her father and mother separated and left her with his mother in Tiverton. She talks about how much she missed her mother, and how she cried herself to sleep for months, and now she cries again. This makes me wonder, if ever I had been sent to live in comfort with a relation, would I have missed my family? It's hard to think I would have missed the same tea and bread every day, the collapsed bed swarming with fleas, a lavatory shared by all the families in the lane. No, I wouldn't have missed that, but I would have missed the way it was with my mother and brothers, the talk around the table, and the nights around the fire when we saw worlds in the flames, little caves and volcanoes, and all kinds of shapes and images. I would have missed that, even if I lived with a rich grandmother, and I felt sorry for Mike Small, who had no brothers and sisters, and no fire to sit at. She tells me how excited she was the day she graduated from elementary school, how her father was to travel all the way up from New York for the party, but called at the last minute to say he had to go to a picnic for tugboat men, and the memory of that brings the tears again. That day on the phone, her grandmother blasted her father, told him he was a no-good, skirt-chasing bastard, and not to set foot in Tiverton again. At least her grandmother was there. She was there for everything, always. She wasn't much for the kissing and hugging and tucking in, but she kept the house clean, the clothes laundered, the lunchbox well-stuffed every day for school. Mike wipes her tears and says, "You can't have everything. And even if I say nothing, I wonder why you can't have everything, or at least give everything. Why can't you clean the house, launder the clothes, stuff the lunchbox, and still kiss, hug, and tuck in?" I can't say this to Mike because she admires her grandmother for being tough, and I prefer to hear that Grandma might have hugged, kissed, and tucked in. With Bob away at ROTC camp, Mike invites me to visit her family. She lives on Riverside Drive near Columbia University with her father, Alan, and her new stepmother, Stella. Her father is a tugboat captain for the Dalzell Towing Company in New York Harbor. Her stepmother is pregnant. Her grandmother, Zoe, is here from Rhode Island for a while, till Mike settles in and gets used to New York. Mike tells me her father likes to be called captain, and when I say, "Hello, captain," he growls till the phlegm rattles in his throat, squeezes my hand till the knuckles crack, so that I'll know how manly he is. Stella says, "Hi, honey," and kisses my cheek. She tells me she's Irish, too, and it's nice to see Alberta going out with Irish boys. Even she says boys, and she's Irish. Grandmother lies on the living room couch with her hands joined under her head, and when Mike introduces me, Zoe's hairline twitches forward, and she says, "How you doing?" It slips out of my mouth. "Nice easy life you have there on the couch." She glares at me, and I know I've said the wrong thing, and it's awkward when Mike and Stella go to another room to look at a dress, and I'm left standing in the middle of the living room with the captain smoking a cigarette and reading the Daily News. No one speaks to me. And I'm wondering how Mike Small can go off and leave me standing here with the father and the grandmother ignoring me. I never know what to say to people at times like this. Should I say, "How's the tugboat business?" Or should I tell the grandmother she did a wonderful job raising Mike? My mother in Limerick would never leave anyone standing in the middle of the room like this. She'd say, "Sit down there and we'll have a nice cup of tea." Because in the lanes of Limerick, it's a bad thing to ignore anyone, and even worse, to forget the cup of tea. It's strange that a man with a good job like the captain and his mother on the couch wouldn't bother to ask me if I had a mouth in my head or if I'd like to sit down. I don't know how Mike can leave me standing like this, though I know if this ever happened to her, she'd simply sit down and make everyone feel cheerful the way my brother Maliki does. What would happen if I sat down? Would they say, "Oh, you're feeling pretty relaxed sitting down without being asked"?
Or will they say nothing and wait till I leave to talk behind my back? They'll talk behind my back anyway, and tell each other Bob is a much nicer boy and looks handsome in his ROTC uniform. Though they might have said as much if they'd seen me in my summer khakis with my corporal stripes. I doubt it. They probably prefer him with his high school diploma and his clear, healthy eyes and his bright future and his cheerful nature all done up in his officer's uniform. And I know from the history books the Irish were never liked up there in New England, that there were signs everywhere saying, no Irish need apply. Well, I don't want to beg anyone for anything, and I'm ready to turn on my heel and walk out when Mike bounces down the hall all blonde and smiling, and ready for a walk and dinner in the village. I'd like to tell her I don't want to have anything to do with people who leave you standing in the middle of the floor and hang out signs rejecting the Irish. But she's so bright and blue-eyed and cheerful, so clean and American. I think if she told me stand there forever, I'd be like a dog and wag my tail and do it. Then on the way down in the elevator, she tells me I said the wrong thing to Grandma, that Grandma is 65 and works very hard cooking and keeping the house clean, and doesn't like people's smart-ass remarks about taking a few minutes on the couch. What I want to say is this, oh, fuck your Grandma and her cooking and cleaning. She has plenty of food and drink and clothes and furniture and hot and cold running water and no shortage of money. And what the bloody hell is she complaining about? There are women all over the world raising large families and not whining. And there's your grandmother lying on her arse complaining she has to take care of an apartment and a few people. Fuck your grandma again. That is what I want to say. Except that I have to swallow my words in case Mike Small might be offended and never see me again. And it's very hard going through life not saying what comes to your tongue. It's hard being with a beautiful girl like her, because she'd never have any trouble getting someone else. And I'd probably have to find a girl not as good-looking who didn't mind my bad eyes and my lack of a high school diploma. Though a girl not as good-looking might offer me a chair and a cup of tea, and I wouldn't have to swallow my words all the time. Andy Peters is always telling me, life is easier with plain-looking girls, especially ones with small tits or no tits, because they're always grateful for the least bit of attention, and one might even love me for myself, as they say in the movies. I can't even think of Mike Small having tits the way she's reserving the whole body for the wedding night and the honeymoon, and it gives me a pain to picture Bob the football player having the excitement with her on the wedding night. The platform boss from the Baker & Williams warehouse sees me on the subway train and tells me I can get work during the summer with men going on vacation. He lets me work 8 to noon, and when I'm finished on the second day, I walk over to Port Warehouses to see if I can have a sandwich with Horace. I often think he's the father I'd like to have, even if he's black and I'm white. If ever I said that to anyone at the warehouse, I'd be laughed off the platform. He must know himself the way they talk about black people, and he surely hears the word nigger floating through the air. When I worked on the platform with him, I wondered how he could keep his fist to himself. Instead, he'd put his head down and have a little smile, and I thought he might be a bit deaf or simple in his mind, but because I knew he wasn't deaf, and the way he talked about his son getting an education in Canada showed that if he'd had a chance, he would have been in a university himself. He's coming out of a diner on Late Street. When he sees me, he smiles. Oh, man, I must have known you were coming. I got a hero sandwich, a mile long, and a beer. We eat on the pier, okay? I'm ready to walk back down Late Street to the pier, but he steers me away. He doesn't want the men at the warehouse to see us. They'd ride him all day. They'd laugh and ask Horace when he knew my mother. That makes me want to defy them and walk Late Street even more. No, man, he says, save your emotions for bigger things. This is a big thing, Horace. It's nothing, man. It's ignorance. We should fight back. No, son. God. He's calling me son. No, son. I don't have time for fighting back. I won't step on their ground. I pick my own fights.
I have a son in college. I have a wife who is ailing and still cleaning offices at night on Broad Street. Eat your sandwich, Mon. It's ham and cheese slathered with mustard, and we wash it down with a quarter of Rheingold, passing the bottle back and forth. And I have a sudden thought and a feeling that I'll never forget this hour on the pier with Horace, with seagulls circling for what might come, and ships strung along the Hudson, waiting for tugboats to dock them or push them out to the Narrows, traffic rushing behind us and over our heads on the West Side Highway, a radio in the pier office with Vaughan Munro singing Buttons and Bows, Horace offering me another chunk of sandwich, telling me I could use a few pounds in my bones, and his surprised look when I nearly dropped the sandwich, nearly dropped it because of the weakness in my heart and the way the tears are dropping on the sandwich, and I don't know why. Can't explain it to Horace or myself with the power of this sadness that tells me this won't come again, this sandwich, this beer on the pier with Horace, that makes me feel so happy. All I can do is weep with the sadness in it. And I feel so foolish I'd like to rest my head on his shoulder, and he knows that because he moves closer, puts his arm around me, as if I were his own son, the two of us, black or white or nothing. And it doesn't matter, because there's nothing to do but put down the sandwich, where a seagull swoops in and gobbles it, and we laugh, Horace and I, and he puts in my hand the whitest handkerchief I've ever seen. And when I offer it back, he shakes his head, "Keep it." And I tell myself, I'll keep that handkerchief till my last breath. I tell him what my mother used to say when we cried, "All your bladder must be near your eye," and he laughs. He doesn't seem to mind if we go back up Blade Street, and the men on the platform say nothing about him and my mother, because it's hard to hurt people already laughing, and beyond you. Chapter 33. Sometimes she's invited to cocktail parties. She takes me along, and I'm confused with the way people stand nose to nose chatting and eating little things and bits of stale bread and crackers. No one's singing or telling a story the way they did in Limerick, till they start looking at their watches and saying, "Are you hungry? Want to go eat something?" And out they drift, and that's what they call a party. That's the uptown New York, and I don't like it one bit. Especially when a man in a suit talks to Mike, tells her he's a lawyer, nods towards me, asks her why in heaven's name she's going out with someone like me, and invites her to go to dinner as if she should walk away and leave me with the empty glass, everything stale and nobody singing. Of course she says, "No thanks," though you can see she's flattered, and I often wondered if she'd like to go with Mr. Lawyer in the suit rather than stay with me, a man from a slum who never went to high school and gawks at the world with two eyes like piss holes in the snow. Surely she'd like to marry someone with clear blue eyes and spotless white teeth who would take her to cocktail parties and move to Westchester where they'd join the country club, play golf and drink martinis and frolic in the night in the grip of the gin. I know already what I prefer myself. The downtown New York, where men with beards and women with long hair and beads are reading poetry in coffee houses and bars. Their names are in the papers and magazines, Kerouac, Ginsberg, Bridget O'Shaughnessy. When they're not living in lofts and tenements, they roam the country. They drink wine from great jugs. They smoke marijuana. They lie on floors and dig the jazz. Dig. That's the way they talk. And they click their fingers. Cool, man, cool. They're like my Uncle Pa in Limerick. They don't give a fiddler's fart about anything. If they had to go to a cocktail party or wear a tie, they'd die. A tie was the cause of our first disagreement, and the first time I saw Mike Small's temper. We were to go to a cocktail party, and when I met her outside her apartment building on Riverside Drive, she said, "Where's your tie?" "It's at home." "But this is a cocktail party." "I don't like wearing ties. They don't wear them down in the village." "I don't care what they wear in the village. This is a cocktail party, and all the men will be wearing ties. You're in America now. Let's go up to a men's store on Broadway and get you a tie." "Why should I buy a tie when I have one at home?" "Because I'm not going to that party with you in that condition." She walked away from me, up 116th Street to Broadway, stuck her hand out, jumped into a taxi without giving me a second look to see if I was coming. I took the 7th Avenue train to Washington Heights in a blind agony, cursing myself for my stubbornness and worrying she might give me up completely for a Mr. Lawyer in a suit, that she might spend the rest of the summer going to cocktail parties with him till Bob the football player returned from ROTC. She might even give up Bob for the lawyer, finish college and move to Westchester or Long Island, where all the men wear ties, where some have ties for every day of the week and social functions on top of it. She might be happy going to the country club all dressed up and remembering what her father said. A lady is not properly dressed till she has white gloves up to her elbows. Paddy Arthur was coming down the stairs, all dressed up, no tie, on his way to an Irish dance. Why didn't I go with him? I might meet Dolores again, ha ha. I turned and went back downstairs, telling him I didn't care if I never saw Dolores again in this life or the next, after what she did luring me onto the E-train and all the way to Queen's Village, letting me think there might be a bit of excitement at the end of the night. Before getting on the downtown train, Paddy and I stopped for a beer at a Broadway bar, and Paddy said, "Jesus, what's up with you? Is it some kind of a bee you have up your arse?" When I told him about Mike Small and the tie, he wasn't a bit sympathetic. He said, "That's what I get for running around with them fucking Protestants, and what would my poor mother say back in Limerick?" I don't care what my mother would say. I'm mad about Mike Small. He asked for a whiskey and told me I should have one too, loosen me up, calm me down, clear my head. And once I had two whiskeys in my system, I told him how I'd like to lie on a Greenwich Village floor smoking marijuana, sharing a jug of wine with a long-haired girl, Charlie Parker on the phonograph, floating us to heaven and easing us down again on a long, low, sweet wail. Paddy gave me the fierce look. "Ella, for Jesus' sake, is it Codmy you are? Do you know the trouble with you? Protestants and Negroes. Next thing it'll be Jews, and then you're doomed altogether." There was an old man smoking a pipe on the stool beside Paddy, and he said, "That's right, son, that's right. Tell your friend, Ed, that you have to stick with your own. All me life I stuck with me own. Dug holes for the phone company, all Irish. Never a bit of trouble, because by Jesus, I stuck with me own. And I seen young fellas coming over and marrying all kinds and losing their faith, and the next thing, they're going to baseball games, and that's the end of them." The old man said he knew a man from his own town who worked 25 years in a pub in Czechoslovakia and came home to settle down without a word of Czechoslovakian in his head, and all because he stuck to his own kind. The few Irishmen he could find there all sticking together, thank God and his blessed mother. The old man said he'd like to buy us a drink to honor the men and women of Ireland who stick with their own, so that when a child is born, they know who the father is, and that, by Christ, God forgive the language, is the most important thing of all, knowing who the father is. We raised the glasses and toasted all who stick with their own and know who the father is. Paddy leaned towards the old man, and they talked about home, which is Ireland, though the old man hadn't seen it for 40 years and hoped to be buried in the lovely town of Gort beside his poor old Irish mother, and his father, who did his bit in the long struggle against the perfidious Saxon tyrant, and he raised his glass to sing, "God save Ireland," says the heroes, "God save Ireland," says them all, "whether on the scaffold high, or the battlefield we die, oh, what matter when for Erin's sake we fall." They sank deeper and deeper into their whiskey, and I stared into the bar mirror, wondering who's kissing Mike Small now, wishing I could be parading the streets with her so that heads would turn, and I'd be the envy of one and all. Paddy and the old man talked to me only to remind me that thousands of men and women died for Ireland who'd hardly be happy with my behavior, the way I run around with Episcopalians betraying the cause. Paddy gave me his back again, and I was left to gawk at what I could see of myself in the mirror and wonder at the world I found myself in. From time to time, the old man leaned around Paddy to tell me, "Stick to your own, stick to your own." I'm in New York, land of the free and the home of the brave. But I'm supposed to behave as if I was still in Limerick, Irish at all times. I'm expected to go out only with Irish girls who frighten me with the way they're always in a state of grace, saying no to everything and everyone, unless it's a petty muck who wants to settle in a farm or land in Roscommon and bring up 7 children, 3 cows, 5 sheep and a pig. I don't know why I returned to America. If I have to listen to the sad stories of Ireland's sufferings and dance with country girls, Mullingar heifers, beef to the heels. There's nothing in my head but Mike Small, blonde, blue-eyed, delicious, sailing through life in her easy Episcopalian way, the all-American girl with sweet memories of Tiverton in her head, the small town in Rhode Island, the house where her grandmother reared her, the bedroom with little curtains moving gently at the windows that looked out on the Narragansett River, the bed dressed with sheets, blankets, pillows galore, blonde head on pillow, filled with dreams of outings, hayrides, trips to Boston, boys, 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 and grandma in the morning setting out the nourishing all-American breakfast so that her little girl can move through the day, charming the arse off every boy, girl, teacher, and anyone she meets, including me and mostly me, as I sit stricken on the bar stool. There was a darkness in my head from the whiskey, and I was ready to tell Paddy and the old man, I'm weary of Ireland's sufferings, and I can't live in 2 countries at the same time. Instead, I left the two of them colloguing on their bar stools, and walked from 179th Street down Broadway to 116th Street, hoping that if I waited long enough, I'd have one glimpse of Mike Small being brought home by Mr. Lawyer in a suit, a glimpse I want and don't want, till a cop in a patrol car calls to me and tells me, move on, buddy, all the Barnard girls are gone to bed. Move on, says the cop. And I did, because there was no use trying to tell him I know who's kissing her now, that she's surely at a movie with a lawyer's arm around her, the tips of his fingers dangling at the border of her breast, which is reserved for the honeymoon, that there might be a kiss or a squeeze between popcorn munches. And I'm here on Broadway, looking at the gates of Columbia University across the street, and I don't know which way to turn. Wishing I could find a girl from California or Oklahoma, all blonde and blue-eyed like Mike Small, all cheerful, with teeth that never knew an ache or cavity, all cheerful because her life is laid out so that she'll graduate from college and marry a nice boy. Boy, she calls him, and settle down in peace, ease, and comfort, as my mother used to say. The cop came at me again and told me, keep moving, pal. And I tried to cross 116th Street with a bit of dignity so that he wouldn't be able to point the finger and tell his partner, there goes another whiskey head Mick from the old country. They didn't know and wouldn't care that all this was happening because Mike Small wanted me to wear a tie. And I refused. The West End bar was packed with Columbia students, and I thought if I had a beer, I might merge in and be mistaken for one of them, higher on the scale than NYU students. A blonde might take a fancy to me and get my mind off Mike Small, though I didn't think I could shrug her off, even if Brigitte Bardot herself slipped between my sheets. I might as well be in the NYU cafeteria, the way these Columbia students argued at the top of their voices about the emptiness of life, how absurd everything is and how all that matters is grace under pressure, man. When that bull's horn comes at you and grazes your hip, you know that's the moment of truth, man. Read your Hemingway, man. Read your J. Paul Sartre, man. They know the score. If I didn't have to work in banks, docks, warehouses, I'd have time to be a proper college student and moan over the emptiness. I wish my father and mother had lived respectable lives and sent me to college so that I could spend my time in bars and cafeterias telling everyone how I admire Camus for his daily invitation to suicide and Hemingway for risking the bull's horn in the side. I know if I had the money and time, I'd be superior to every student in New York in the despair department, though I could never mention any of this to my mother because she'd say, Ara, for God's sake, don't you have your health and shoes and a fine head of hair? What more do you want? I drank my beer and wondered, what kind of a country is this, where cops keep telling you move on, where people put pigeon shit in your ham sandwich. Or a girl who's engaged to be engaged to a football player walks away from me because I'm not wearing a tie. Or a nun will baptize Michael, what's left of him, though he suffered in a concentration camp and deserves to be left in his Jewish condition bothering no one. Where college students eat and drink to their heart's content and moan about existentialism and the emptiness of everything, and cops tell you once again, move on. I walk back up Broadway past Columbia into Washington Heights and over to the George Washington Bridge, where I could look up and down the Hudson River. My head was filled with dark clouds and noises and a coming and going of Limerick and Dachau and Ed Klein, where Michael, what's left of him, a piece of offer, was saved by GIs. And my mother moved in and out of my head with Emma from Mayo and Mike Small from Rhode Island, and Patty Arthur laughed and said, "You'll never dance with Irish girls with them two eyes like piss holes in the snow." And I looked up and down the river and felt sorry for myself, till the sky brightened beyond and the sun coming up traveled from tower to tower, turning Manhattan into pillars of gold. Chapter 34. A few days later, she calls me in tears. She's out in the street, and would I come and get her at 116th Street? There was trouble with her father. She has no money and doesn't know what to do. She's waiting on the corner, and on the train she tells me how she got dressed with every intention of calling me and meeting me, even though I had strong feelings about ties. But her father said no, she wasn't going out, and she said yes, she was going out, and he punched her in the mouth, which, as I can see, is swelling. She ran from her father's house, and there's no going back. Mary O'Brien says she's in luck. One of the boarders has gone back to Ireland to marry a girl down the road, and his room is available. In a way, I'm glad her father punched her because she came to me instead of Bob, and that surely means she prefers me. Of course Bob is unhappy, and in a few days there he is at the door calling me a sneaky little bog trotter and telling me he's going to break my head. But I move my head to one side, and his fist crashes against the wall, and he has to go to the hospital for a cast. On the way out, he threatens he'll see me again, and I'd better make my peace with my maker. Though when I run into him a few days later at NYU, he offers his good hand in friendship, and I never see him again. He may be calling Mike Small behind my back, but it's too late, and she shouldn't even be talking to him, since she already allowed me into her room and into her bed, forgetting how she was reserving the body for the wedding night and the honeymoon. The night of our first excitement, she tells me I've taken her virginity, and if I should feel guilty or sad, I can't, especially when I know I'm the first, the one that stays forever in any girl's memory, as they used to say in the army. We can't stay at Mary O'Brien's because we can't resist the temptation to be in the same bed, and there are knowing looks. Petty Arthur stops talking to me altogether, and I'm not sure if he's been pious or patriotic, angry that I'm with someone neither Catholic nor Irish. The captain sends word he's ready to give Mike a certain amount of money every month, and that means she can rent a small apartment in Brooklyn. I'd like to live with her, but the captain and the grandmother would think that disgraceful, so I rent my own cold water flat at 46 Downing Street in Greenwich Village. They call it a cold water flat, and I don't know why. It has hot water, but no heat, except for a large kerosene heater, which turns so red I'm afraid it might blow up. The only thing I can do to keep warm is to buy an electric blanket at Macy's and plug it into a long cord that lets me wander around. There's a bathtub in the kitchen and a lavatory in the hallway I must share with an old Italian couple across the hall. The old Italian man knocks on my door to tell me I'm to put my own toilet paper on the holder in the lavatory, and I'm to keep my hands off his. He and his wife mark their toilet paper, and they'll know if I try to use it, so watch out. His English is poor, and when he starts to tell me of the troubles he had with the previous tenants in my flat, he becomes so frustrated he shakes his fist in my face and warns me I could be in big trouble if I touch his toilet paper, big trouble, yet gives me a roll to start me off to make sure I don't touch his. He says his wife is a nice woman, and giving me the roll is her idea. that she's a sick woman who wants a quiet life and no trouble. Capiche? Mike finds a small apartment on Henry Street in Brooklyn Heights. She has her own bathroom, and no one torments her over toilet paper. She says, "My apartment is a disgrace," and she doesn't know how I can live like that. No heat, no place to cook, Italians yelling over toilet paper. She feels sorry for me and lets me stay over. She makes delicious dinners even though she didn't even know how to make coffee when her father punched her out of the house. When classes end, she goes back to Rhode Island to have her dentist examine the abscess caused by her father's fist. I'm taking summer session courses at NYU, reading, studying, writing term papers. I'm working at the bank, the midnight to eight shift, and operating the forklift at the Baker and Williams warehouse 2 days a week, dreaming of Mike Small nice and cozy with her grandmother in Rhode Island. She calls to tell me her grandmother isn't that angry with me anymore over what I said about her easy life. Grandma even said something nice about me. What was that? She said, "You have a nice head of black curly hair," and she feels so sorry about the thing with my father, she doesn't mind if you come here for a day or two. After what happened to me in the bank, I could go to Rhode Island for a week. A man sat next to me in a coffee shop on Broad Street near where I worked. Told me he'd heard me talk the night before and figured I was Irish, right? I am. Yeah, well, I'm Irish too. Irish as Paddy's pig. Father from Carlo, mom from Sligo. I hope you don't mind, but I got your name from someone and found you're a member of the Teamsters in the ILA. My ILA card expired. That's okay. I'm an organizer and we're trying to break into these fucking banks, excuse the language. Are you on for that? Oh, sure. I mean, you're the only one we could get on your shift with any kind of union history. And what we'd like you to do is just drop little hints. You know, and they know, the banks pay shit wages, so just a little hint here and there, not too many, not too soon, and I'll see you in a few weeks. Here, I'll take care of the bill. Next night is Thursday, pay night, and when we receive our checks, the supervisor says, "You've got the rest of the night off, McCourt." He makes sure everyone in the shift hears him. "You're off tonight, McCourt, and all the other nights. And you can tell that to your union friends. This is a bank, and we don't need any goddamn unions." They say nothing, the typists, the clerks. They nod. Andy Peters would say something, but he's still on the 4-12 shift. I take my check, and as I wait for the elevator, an executive comes out of his office. "McCourt, right?" I nod. "So you're finishing college, right?" I am. "Ever think of joining us here? You could come aboard and we'd have you up to a nice five-figure salary in 3 years. I mean, you're one of our own, right? Irish?" I am. "Me too. Father from Wicklow, mom from Dublin. And when you work at a bank like this, doors open, you know. AOH, Knights of Columbus, all that there. We take care of our own. If we don't, who will?" "I was just fired." "Fired? What the hell are you talking about? Fired for what?" "For letting a union organizer talk to me in a coffee shop." "You did that? Let a union organizer talk to you?" "I did." "That was a stupid damn thing to do. Look, pal, we're out of the coal mines, we're out of the kitchens and the ditches. We don't need unions. Will the Irish ever get sense? Asking you a question, talking to you." I say nothing here and on the elevator going down. I say nothing because I've been fired from this bank and there's nothing to say anyway. I don't want to talk about the Irish getting sense. And I don't know why everyone I meet has to tell me where his father and mother came from in Ireland. The man wants to argue with me, but I won't give him the satisfaction. It's better to walk away and leave him to the height he grew, as my mother used to say. He calls after me to tell me I'm an asshole, that I'll wind up digging ditches, delivering beer barrels, pouring whiskey for boozy mix in a Blarney Stone bar. He says, "Jesus, is there anything wrong with looking after your own kind?" And the strange thing is, there's something in his voice that's sad, as if I were a son that disappointed him. Mike Small meets my train in Providence, Rhode Island, takes me by bus to Tiverton. On the way, we stop at a liquor store for a bottle of Pilgrim's Rum, Grandma's favorite. Zoe, the grandmother, says hi, but doesn't offer hand or cheek. It's dinner time, and there's corned beef and cabbage and boiled potatoes because that's what the Irish like to eat, according to Zoe. She says I must be tired from the trip, and surely I'd like a drink. Mike looks at me and smiles, and we know it's Zoe who wants a drink, rum and coke. How about you, Grandma? Would you like a drink? Well, I don't know, but all right. Are you making the drinks, Alberta? Yes. Well, go easy with the coke. It kills my stomach. We sit in a living room, dark from layers of blinds, curtains, drapes. There are no books, magazines, newspapers, and the only pictures are of the captain in his army lieutenant's uniform, and one of Mike, a blonde angel of a child. We sip our drinks, and there's a silence because Mike is in the hallway answering the phone, and Zoe and I have nothing to say to each other. I wish I could say this is a nice house, but I can't, because I don't like the darkness of this room when the sun is beaming outside. Then Zoe calls out, Alberta, you gonna stay on that goddamn phone all night? You have a guest. She says to me, that's Charlie Moran she's talking to. They was great friends all through school, but goddamn he likes to talk. Charlie Moran, is it? Mike leaves me here in this gloomy room with Grandma while she chatters away with her old boyfriend. All these weeks in Rhode Island, she's been having a grand time of it with Charlie, while I'm slaving away in banks and warehouses. Zoe says, make yourself another drink, Frank. That means she wants one too. And when she tells me, go easy on the coke, it kills her stomach, I double her rum dosage, hoping it will knock her out, so that I can have my way with her granddaughter. But no, the drink makes her livelier, and after a few swallows she says, let's eat, goddammit. Irishmen like to eat. And while we're eating, she says, you like that, Frank? I do. Well, then eat it. You know what I always say? A meal ain't a meal without a potato, and I'm not even Irish. No, goddammit, not a drop of Irish. There's a bit of Scotch. MacDonald was my mother's name. That's Scotch, isn't it? 'Tis. Not Irish. No. After dinner, we watch television, and she falls asleep in her armchair after telling me that Louis Armstrong, there on the screen, is ugly as sin and can't sing worth a damn. Mike shakes her and tells her to go to bed. Don't tell me go to bed, goddammit. You might be a college student, but I'm still your grandmother. Isn't that right, Bob? I'm not Bob. You're not? Well, who are you? I'm Frank. Oh, the Irishman. Well, Bob's a nice fella. He's going to be an officer. What are you going to be?
A teacher.
A teacher? Oh, well, you won't be driving no Cadillac. And she pulls herself up the stairs to bed. Now, surely, with Zoe snoring away in her room, Mike will visit my bed, but no, she's too nervous. What if Zoe woke suddenly and discovered us? I'd be out on the road hailing the bus to Providence. It's a torment when Mike comes to kiss goodnight, and even in the dark, I know she's in her pink baby doll pajamas. She won't stay. I know, Grandma might hear, and I tell her I wouldn't care if God himself were in the next room. No, no, she says, and leaves. And I wonder, what kind of world is this where people will walk away from a chance of a wild fling in the bed? At dawn, Zoe runs the vacuum cleaner upstairs and downstairs and complains, this goddamn house looks like Hogan's Alley. The house is spotless because she has nothing else to do but clean it. And she barks about Hogan's Alley to put me in my place because she knows, I know, it was a dangerous Irish slum in New York. She complains the vacuum cleaner doesn't pick up the way it used to, though it's easy to see there's nothing to pick up. She complains that Alberta sleeps too late, and is she supposed to make three separate breakfasts, her own, mine, Alberta's? Her neighbor Abby drops in, and they drink coffee and complain about kids, dirt, television, that goddamn ugly Louis Armstrong who can't sing, dirt, the price of food and clothes, kids, the goddamn Portuguese taking over everything in Fall River and surrounding towns,
Bad enough when the Irish ran everything. At least they could speak English as long as they were sober. They complain about hairdressers who charge a fortune and can't tell a decent hairdo from a donkey's ass. Oh, Zoe, says Abby, your language. Well, I mean it, goddammit. If my mother were here, she'd be puzzled. She'd wonder why these women complain. Lord above, she'd say, they have everything. They're warm and clean and well-fed, and they complain about everything. My mother and the women in the slums of Limerick had nothing and rarely complained. They said it was the will of God. Zoe has everything but complains with the music of the vacuum cleaner, and that may be her way of prayer, God damn it. In Tiverton, Mike is Alberta. Zoe complains she doesn't know why a girl would want to use a goddamn name like Mike when she has her own name, Agnes Alberta. We walk around Tiverton, and I imagine again what it would be like to be a teacher here, married to Alberta. We'd have a sparkling kitchen where every morning I'd have my coffee and an egg and read the Providence Journal. We'd have a big bathroom with plenty of hot water and thick towels with powerful naps. And I might loll there in the tub and gaze on the Narragansett River through little curtains billowing gently in the morning sun. We'd have a car for trips to Horseneck Beach and Block Island, and we'd visit Alberta's mother's relations in Nantucket. As the years passed, my hair would recede, my belly protrude. Friday nights, we'd attend local high school basketball games, and I'd meet someone who might sponsor me for the country club. If they admitted me, I'd have to take up golf, and that would surely be the end of me, the first step towards the grave. A visit to Tiverton is enough to drive me back to New York. Chapter 35. In the summer of 1957, I complete my degree courses at NYU, and in the autumn pass the Board of Education exams for teaching high school English. An afternoon newspaper, the World Telegram and Sun, has a school page where teachers can find jobs. Most of the vacancies are for vocational high schools, and friends have already warned me, don't go near those vocational high schools. The kids are killers. They'll chew you up and spit you out. Look at that movie, The Blackboard Jungle, where a teacher says vocational schools are the garbage cans of the school system, and the teachers are there to sit on the lid. See that movie, and you'll run in the other direction. There is a vacancy for an English teacher at Samuel Gomper's Vocational High School in the Bronx, but the chairman of the academic department tells me I look too young, and the kids would give me a hard time. He says his father was from Donegal, his mother from Kilkenny, and he'd like to help me. We should take care of our own, but his hands are tied, and the way he shrugs and extends his open palms contradicts what he said entirely. Still, he heaves himself from his chair and walks me to the front door with his arm across my shoulders. Tells me I should try Samuel Gompers again. Maybe in a year or two I'd fill out and lose that innocent look. And he'd keep me in mind, though I needn't bother to come back if I grew a beard. He can't stand beards, and he wants no goddamn beatniks in his department. Meanwhile, he says, I might try the Catholic high schools where the pay isn't that good, but I'd be with my own kind of people, and a nice Irish kid should stick with his own. The academic chairman at Grady Vocational High School in Brooklyn says, yeah, he'd like to help me out, but you know, with that brogue, you'd have trouble with the kids. They might think you talk funny, and teaching is hard enough when you speak properly, and doubly hard with a brogue. He wants to know how I passed the speech part of the teacher's license examination. And when I tell him I was issued a substitute license on condition I take remedial speech, he says, yeah, maybe you could come back when you don't sound like Paddy off the boat, ha ha ha. He tells me in the meantime I should stick with my own people. He's Irish himself, well, three-quarters Irish. And you never know with other people. When I meet Andy Peters for a beer, I tell him I can't get a teaching job till I fill out and look older and talk like an American. And he says, shit, forget the teaching, go into business, specialize in something. Hubcaps. Corner the market. Get a job in a garage and learn all you can about hubcaps.
People come into the garage and hubcaps are mentioned and everyone turns to you. A hubcap crisis? You know, where a hubcap falls off, flies through the air and decapitates a model housewife, and all the TV stations call you for your expert opinion. Then you can go out on your own. McCord's Hubcap Emporium. Foreign and domestic hubcaps, new and old. Antique hubcaps for the discerning collector.
Is he serious? Maybe not about hubcaps. He says, look at what they do in the academic world. You corner a half acre of human knowledge. Chaucer's phallic imagery in The Wife of Bath, or Swift's devotion to shit, and you build a fence around it, decorate the fence with footnotes and bibliographies, post a sign, keep off, trespassers will lose their tenure. I'm engaged myself in a noble search for a Mongolian philosopher. I thought of cornering the market on an Irish philosopher, but all I could find was Berkeley, and they've got their claws into him already. One Irish philosopher, for Christ's sakes, one. Don't you people ever ponder? So I'm stuck with the Mongolians or the Chinese, and I'll probably have to learn Mongolian or Chinese, or whatever the hell they speak there, and when I find him, he'll be my very own. When was the last time you heard a Mongolian philosopher mentioned at those East Side cocktail parties you like so much? I'll get my PhD, write a few articles on my Mongolian in obscure scholarly journals. I'll deliver learned lectures to drunken Orientalists at MLA conventions, and wait for the job offers to pour in from the Ivy League and its cousins. I'll get a tweed jacket, a pipe, and a pompous manner, and faculty wives will be throwing themselves at me, begging me to recite, in English, erotic Mongolian verses smuggled into the country up the ass of a yak or a panda at the Bronx Zoo. And I'll tell you another thing. Piece of advice in case you go to graduate school. When you take a course, always find out what the professor wrote his doctoral dissertation on and give it back to him. If the guy specializes in Tennyson's water images, then pour it all over him. If the guy specializes in George Berkeley, give him the sound of one hand clapping while a tree falls in the forest. How do you think I got through these fucking philosophy courses at NYU? If the guy's a Catholic, I give him Aquinas. Jewish, I give him Maimonides. Agnostic, you never know what to tell an agnostic. You never know where you stand with them, though you can always try old Nietzsche. You can bend that old fucker any way you like.
Andy tells me, Byrd was the greatest American who ever lived. Right up there with Abraham Lincoln and Max Kiss, the guy who invented X-Lax. Byrd should be given the Nobel Prize and a seat in the House of Lords. Who's Byrd? For Christ's sakes, McCourt, I worry about you. You tell me you love jazz, and you don't know from Byrd. Charlie Parker, man. Mozart, you listening to me? You dig? Mozart, for Christ's sakes. That's Charlie Parker. What does Charlie Parker have to do with teaching jobs or hubcaps or Maimonides or anything else? You see, McCourt, that's your problem. Always looking for relevance, a sucker for logic. That's why the Irish don't have philosophers. Lot of goddamn barroom theologians and shithouse lawyers. Loosen up, man. Thursday night I finish early and we'll take a trip to 52nd Street for a little music, okay? We go from club till we come to one place where a black woman in a white dress croaks into a microphone and holds on as if she were on a swaying ship. Andy whispers, that's Billy. And it's a disgrace they're letting her make an ass of herself up there. He marches to the stage and tries to take her hand to help her down, but she curses him and swings at him till she stumbles and falls off the stage. Another man leaves his bar stool and leads her out the door. And I know from the clear sounds between her croaks that was Billie Holiday, the voice I heard on the Armed Forces Network when I was a boy in Limerick, a pure voice telling me, I can't give you anything but love, baby. Andy says, that's what happens. What do you mean, that's what happens? I mean, that's what happens, that's all. Jesus, do I have to write a book?
How is it you know Billie Holiday?
I have loved Billie Holiday since I was a child. I come to 52nd Street to catch glimpses of her. I would hold her coat. I would scour her toilet bowl. I would run her bath water. I would kiss the ground she walks on. I told her I got a dishonorable discharge for not fucking a French sheep, and she thought it should be made into a song. I don't know what God intends to do with me in the next life, but I'm not going unless I can sit between Billy and Bird for eternity.
In the middle of March 1958, there's another notice in the paper. Vacancy for English teacher at McKee Vocational and Technical High School, Staten Island. The assistant principal, Miss Seasted, examines my license and takes me to see the principal, Moses Cirola, who doesn't move from his chair behind the desk where he squints at me through a cloud of smoke drifting from his nose and from the cigarette in his hand. He says, "This is an emergency situation. The teacher I'd be replacing, Miss Mudd, has made an abrupt decision to retire in the middle of the term. He says teachers like that are inconsiderate and make life hard for a principal. He doesn't have a full English program for me, that I'd have to teach 3 classes in social studies every day, 2 in English. But I don't know anything about social studies." He puffs and squints and says, "Don't worry about it," and takes me to the office of the academic chairman, Acting, who says I'd be teaching 3 classes of economic citizenship, and here's the textbook, Your World and You. Mr. Cirola smiles through the smoke and says, "Your World and You, that should cover just about everything." I tell him I know nothing about economics or citizenship, and he says, "Just stay a few pages ahead of the kids. Everything you tell them will be news. Tell them this is 1958, tell them their names, tell them they live in Staten Island, and they'll be surprised and grateful for the information. By the end of the year, even your name will be news to them. Forget your college literature courses. This is not a high IQ plateau." He takes me to see Miss Mudd, the teacher I'm replacing. When he opens the classroom door, boys and girls are leaning out the windows, calling to each other across the schoolyard. Miss Mudd sits at her desk, reading travel brochures, ignoring the paper airplane that zooms over her head. Miss Mudd has retired. Mr. Cirola leaves the room, and she says, "That's right, young man. I can't wait to get out of here. What's this, Wednesday? Friday's my last day, and you're welcome to this loony bin. 32 years I've been at this, and who cares? The kids? Parents? Who young man gives a shit? Forgive my French. We teach their brats, and they pay us like dishwashers. What was the year? 1926. Calvin Coolidge came in. I came in. I worked right through him. And the Depression man, Hoover. And Roosevelt. And Truman. And Eisenhower. Look out that window. You got a good view of New York Harbor from here, and Monday morning, if these kids aren't driving you crazy, you'll see a big ship sailing by, and that'll be me on the deck waving, son, waving and smiling, because there's 2 things I never want to see again in my life with God's help, Staten Island and kids. Monsters, monsters, look at them. You'd be better off working with chimpanzees in the Bronx Zoo. What's this, 1958? How did I ever last? You'd need to be Joe Lewis. So good luck, son. You're gonna need it."